Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, where book clubs are just for women,
and we're going to fill up our dicks with beer. Kay.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Drunk Guys, and this week we are reading Ubik by Philip K. Dick. I'm going to start with a beer, because fuck, this is fucking ridiculous already. I knew it was coming, and it was still funny. So this book, if you thought we didn't understand Ulysses, we're really, at least I knew that was in Ireland. This book, I fucking have no idea what happened. But a lot of it is some weird, you know, dreamy stuff happening when people are like almost dead. It's like they're having daydreams at dusk. Mm. This is a double IPA. Dry hopped with galaxy hops, which at this point in the distant future of 1992, people are starting to explore the galaxy. This is by Timber Ales. It's very nice. It's Ubik, which I'm saying Ubik the whole time. I know that's really not that different, but
personal Ubik. Choice.
Well, if it's from Ubiquitous, which is made clear in the text, then it should be Ubik, right? Is a novel by Philip K. Dick from 1969. And I think, was this my pick?
Yes.
Of a book? Yeah.
Yes.
You're welcome, guys. I'm just nailing them. is wildly and widely acclaimed, not only as a great sci-fi book of its time or just of the genre,
but it's just a great experience of what acid feels like.
Or just like a great book, which we'll talk about that.
But at times, this book felt like, to me, those videos of what English sounds like to people who don't speak English.
So it takes place in 1992.
You
Bill
mean
Clinton
the future?
Has just been elected. Yeah. And there's
when did he write
Colin,
this? The 70s?
69.
69, okay.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, you know what also came out in 1969? The adult film version, Pubik. But that one was by, it was Pubik by Filled with Gay Dick. Different movie. I've seen that more than I like that better than the book. So it's the,
just
it's
as
the future.
Though, honestly.
I like that it is kind of the confidence of people in the 60s that they were like, what is it, 1969? We're putting a man on the moon. I'd say, yeah, 23 years we'll have moon colonies, 1 hour trips to the moon, psychics. Anti-psychics,
yeah.
The psychic thing, maybe not.
Talking to the dead.
I guess if you were to follow the technological pace at which they had gotten there, it maybe wasn't insane to think we'd be able to go to the moon somewhat regularly. In the compared to the 40s to the 60s, of course, at that point we're just like, actually, we're good. We beat the Soviets there, and we're just gonna chill now. We've done everything we need.
But I don't really. I mean, yes, it was an amazing accomplishment, and it did happen. Despite what some other podcasts might say, they were really just like, hey, we figured out how to make planes go up, and we figured out how to make bombs. What if we just combined those two things, and we made a plane that exploded out of its ass until it hits the moon? And they're like, yeah, let's fucking try that. We have fucking, it's a Cold War, baby. let's do it.
Do you know what the earliest rockets were powered with?
Arby's.
Good guess. Alcohol. Pure,
what a terrible
100%
waste.
Alcohol. But
moonshine.
All the fuel would disappear while it was waiting for the next overnight, while it was waiting for the next day.
Well, they shouldn't have had that crew of just guys wearing overalls handling the moonshine.
You know, that one tooth he's got left can bite through the gas cylinder.
He's using that to put the rivets into the rocket. Jesus, Cletus, it's Arby's. I sent you the thing where it's like, you know, this is my paintbrush, and it's a guy holding Taco Bell, and this is my canvas, and it's the toilet. So it's the future, and goddamn, is it confusing. But I'll see if I could start. But Nate and Jimmy will interject, of course.
Oh no, I don't know what happened either.
So I think it's easier to say. There's some stuff you have to just accept happens in this future. So one is that there's this thing called Half-Life. It's a computer game that's popular in the late 90s. But
you just crowbar everything.
the technology that it's any book that predicts stuff for the future, it's just funny. It's like the Neil Gaiman thing, right? Like nothing gets older faster than the future or something like that, right? Because they have near interstellar travel, but they're still paying for things in nickels.
Well, I thought this was kind of like maybe a joke about silly rampant capitalism. Like you have to pay.
It's a funny book in a like a dark Kafka kind of way, but it's just absurd. There's this half-life thing where people who are fairly recently dead can be put on ice, and you could talk to the whatever's left of their brain, and they have a few hours left, and they're just hanging out there with Walt Disney waiting to get spoken to. And that's a thing that you just have to accept.
Yeah.
And then also, it's like X-Men. All of a sudden, a whole lot of people have mutant powers. There are psychics who can read other people's minds. And then there are like the lamest psychics, and they could just block psychics. They're like the defensive linemen of the psychic world. But I'd like to think they look like defensive linemen. They're all 6'5 and 380. They're just like, and they just block a guy's thoughts, and then their face turns purple, and they can't die at 31 thinking. Years old. So there's that, and this psychic shit is the way that all businesses conduct business. It's by trying to psychically steal things.
It's industrial espionage done through psychics, but actual psychics, not like Miss Cleo. Psychics, real psychics.
It's kind of like hackers. Like there's, nerds that do the hacking and then the nerds that protect you against the hacking by doing their own special hacking.
The white hats.
Yeah, which are not the Klan.
Yeah, they chose poorly with that name. But imagine if Miss Cleo was involved in industrial espionage.
The cards she's do like, tell all. Microsoft is going like, down in Q2.
Dumped a MySpace stock. It's like, oh shit, it's gonna tank.
Just like, buy Live Journal.
So wait, I'm sorry, did she say it's tanking or was she just saying thanks but Caribbeanly?
She would be just as effective of an investment advice person as Jim Cramer, and he's been on TV for years.
That's what I'm really picturing, like her on Mad Money with like a fucking hammer, and she's just like, miss it, dump it.
She wasn't even actually Jamaican.
Banana stocks be on pun rise. They go 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch. I'm like, what is she talking about?
Then she presses one of those buttons.
Yeah, like a ooga horn goes off. Oh, yeah, there's a book we're talking about. So any other things that matter? Oh, yeah, and you have to pay for all of your appliances a nickel at a time. Or
it's like your refrigerator. You have to put in a nickel in order to open it.
Your front door, you have to put in a nickel to open it. Or it
that
like you can't leave.
Is a fire hazard.
It's
not
it's
in the
just
future.
Absurd.
There's no more fire in the future.
You'd have to pay for it. Yeah,
yeah, that's true.
So the main so we meet like this, and one of the early things that matters a lot if you want to try to understand this fucking
which is a mistake
puzzle, is that there's what's his name, Glenn Runciter or something like that.
Runciter is the boss man business
he's
guy.
He's the boss
he's
of, this,
the
of this psychic firm. But he's going to visit...
Anti-psychic firm.
Is he the one visiting his wife in the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah, he's visiting his wife.
Because the company is his and his wife's. But she got dead
she died. She
early
died
on. So he's just been freezing her and bringing her back to life for a few minutes at a time to ask her business advice before
like
she dies.
In Foundation. You know, like where whenever there's a problem, I'll send you a clue.
Yeah.
So he has her frozen, and he's old. He's an old man, and he goes and talks to her, and then they go to the moratoriums, which is where you talk to the near-dead, I guess. And all of a sudden, he can't hear her because there's another dead person or near-dead person or whatever they are who's in, like, the chamber next to hers whose brain cat-burglared her.
They put all the half-dead people in a, like a big cryo chamber. And eventually the weaker people start like getting overwritten by the stronger-willed, dead people.
Are you saying there's a triumph of the will, Jimmy?
I think there is some sort of a triumph of the will. I don't think that expression exists anywhere else, but yes, there's definitely a triumph of the will amongst the dead.
And they're like, you have to fight against it. Work will set you free.
Yeah, if you work, you will triumph of your will. I can't believe these phrases are so common. They don't exist anywhere else. Yes.
Someone should have thought of this. And in 1939, stuff's going to happen in this book, actually.
But the main guy in the story is a guy who works for Runciter, who is like, I don't actually know what he does.
He vets the potential psychics. He tests them, and he's like,
he's the only
psychic.
One who knows how to run the equipment that does this test on psychics to see their like psychic field.
He does like the Blade Runner box.
Philip K. Dick recycles.
Also, yeah. So he finds these people who have all these weird superpowers, like that. They just do crazy shit, and one of them might even be like Mr. Crazy Rabbit. This book doesn't make any sense.
I also have a beer for this part.
Let's all drink it. This is called Crazy Rabbit, and it's a Belgian ale from Single Cut. Good luck. It's real good. It's real good. They don't get Belgians anymore.
Mr. Ashwood brings to Joe Chip a woman named Pat, who has some new crazy psychic power that no one's ever seen before.
And is very hot
and takes off her clothes almost immediately.
Because
why?
She has to. Because
she just has to.
You know which couch he's testing her on. It's that. It's the back room.
Anyway, I bought the. So I have a beer for her when I thought she would be a more important character. Would you call her a psychedelic priestess?
Oh yeah.
Alewife.
Yeah.
He's like, listen.
Double IPA.
You'll be making $5,000 a day.
Yeah, it's good. Double IPA.
So her power.
So
is
this
very
is a
rare.
Very short book. It's going to take hours and hours to even attempt to explain the things that happen.
I should have brought more beer.
Unless you're also on acid, in which case those hours will take also hours, but seem like even more hours.
So she has a very rare power in this world, and that is a woman who, when you ask her what's wrong, she actually tells you the first time. Instead of saying it's fine for 42 minutes. I know that's not her power. Her power is she could change the past, which
but
isn't
you don't
even
know that it's
psychic.
Happened.
Yeah.
Because they're also, they're, this world is...
sure, she has the power of gaslighting.
Pretty much.
You said that to your mother. And you're like, oh, fuck. Oh, shit, I did.
in this power. World, there are precogs who can... tell what the future is, and they can like see the different paths the future is going to take. And there are anti-precogs who like make it so that they can't really tell which one is possibles.
Well, it's
shit.
Like they explain it. Like if you're a precog, you see all the possible futures, but one is more prominent. And if you're an anti-cog, then all they see is just meat spin.
It's still buffering.
Like Jesus, the future is terrible.
But what Pat does is makes it so that. She can see, basically...
She can go into the past and change something.
So that she can make the present whatever she wants it to be at that point.
But she kind of only does it once. Actually, she does it twice.
Maybe. Or 5,000 times.
Or in the beginning, and never again after that.
But it's also impossible to know when she does it, because she's the only one that knows when it's happened.
Yeah, so later on when she demonstrates it, all of a sudden the guy's like, that's my wife you're talking to. And she's like, see what I just did there? And he's like, I don't know what you mean, honey.
We've been married for a year. Like, no, we're not. It's like, what are you talking about? It's like, all right.
And she just like thinks it and undoes it. He's like, oh my God, no fault. Divorce is crazy. And then they're not married. It was a very handy plot device that he then didn't use. Like, this could fix every problem in every plot.
So he gives her the test, and then while he's sort of giving her his, he's setting up his very analog equipment and turns up the gain. And she immediately just starts taking off her clothes, and he's like, "Why are you doing that?" Not that I'm complaining. Why are you doing that? She's like, "Oh, because I had to." And then hands him a note, and it's clearly his own handwriting, and it has a little symbol on it that says, "Don't trust this person. This isn't good. I don't believe them." And he's like, see, I told, like, that's what you did before when I didn't take off my clothes. Because why? I didn't, don't understand. But it shows how you're actually going to do the test now and you're going to believe me because I'm showing you this thing that you actually did before. See? Something like that? Almost.
Like, oh, he, yeah. And he has like little secret handwriting. And he's like, oh, this is the symbol that means her ass would indeed quit. I needed to find out for sure.
And instead writes her a recommendation that says, she is amazing. Hire her now. But with a little symbol that says, don't trust her at all. Which is ominous, but is also like not important in the
plot. Because they hire her still?
They still do.
Like, keep an eye on her because she's like too powerful to let it, to let go.
Right. They need to hire her as, so no one else could use her.
This whole thing feels like a first draft.
Yeah, it's Philip K. Dick.
I was going to say that's all of his books.
It's just a first draft. Not that there weren't inventive things in it. But some things just don't add up. Anyway, so she gets hired. So he's like, oh, hires her. And then it switches back to Glenn Runciter.
Dude, expecting this to add up is absurd. This is like, you know, this isn't an addition column. It's like doing non-Euclidean geometry in base 6. Like, it's like there's no adding up. It's just not gibberish to our minds. This guy was tripping balls.
But also, he actually was mentally ill.
He was fucking nuts.
Yes. I forget, did he kill himself or he just died?
He had a stroke.
But yeah, all of his books are like, this is so fucking weird. Who thinks this way? Like, no one does. He died because he thought this way. So you kind of just, for all of his books, you have to like grab on and hold on and pray you make it to the end and then see what happened to you afterwards.
It's like you get to the end, it's like after you just got off a crowded subway car and you just pat your, like, do I still have my wallet at least? And then you're like, all right, I guess I'll just go on now. That's how his books end. Like, all right, nothing permanent.
So they go back, so it switches back to next chapter. It goes back to Glenn Runciter back at the office and a woman comes in and says, we want to hire you. But we won't tell you who we're hiring you for, which doesn't make any sense because obviously if they hire you, they would find out who it was. But anyway, we're going to hire you because
all of international commerce works today. It's like, I didn't hire those child slaves. Someone else did as a subcontractor. And, you know, like I just couldn't figure out who it was.
And they lied to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
anyway, she's like, we need to hire some of your inertials because that's the term for the people who cancel out the psychic people. Oh, and also what you think is going to be important where right at the beginning, it's like, oh, we've lost track of
Mr. Marscapone.
Marscapone, yes. it's like Melipone. Cheese, where is his cheese? And then I thought that was going to be important. It wasn't at all.
It was all a lure.
She comes in and hires them. And he's like, I don't know. And he guess I'm going to get one of my sidekicks to check her out. And then he's like, oh, yeah, no, she works for this other guy who's apparently very rich. I forgot his name already, and I don't care.
Herb Stanton or something like that? Stanton Mick?
Stanton Mick. No.
Hollis. Hollis is the bad guy.
Hollis is the firm of actual psychics because this guy, Runciter, he runs the firm of anti-psychics. I think that's close enough.
Yeah, no, they put together a Ocean's 11 crew of psychics.
And to all those people, mission. I was worried I was really going to have to remember who they were and what their powers were. It turns out you do not. So I was kind of
no.
But there's one worth remembering just for, like, why is this here? And that's Al, who is quote, very tall and very black one.
Yeah.
Who later on he said, I believe they say Negro.
He did, yes.
Which in 1969 was an interesting choice because this will never change in the future.
They're still saying that in 1992.
In the future, we go back to Negro. That's the way.
Were they even saying that in 1969?
I think guys who were born in 1869 were still saying that. Yeah. That's about it. But there's a part. I don't even know what the hell. It doesn't matter when. But Al, they're talking to someone, and Al's like, hey, man, we have to just wait in the lounge, Joe. This is the exact quote. We have to wait in the lounge, Joe, Al said. Next line, nothing being cut out. Joe looked at him fiercely. Uncle Tom, he said. It's, like, it's, like, it's not even what that means. It's like, in the future, there will still be casual racism for no reason.
Well, I mean, he was right about that.
It didn't make any sense.
He was right about casual racism and people making literal references to things they don't know about.
That's not what Uncle Tom did. Uncle Tom was like, hey, man, let's just chill out in the waiting room.
That was the point of that novel, yes.
That character was worth remembering. Every other one, like the Spanish gypsy woman.
Who could like tell like vibes. She was good at, she was a shaman, basically.
She read your chakra or some bullshit. Kind of.
And there was, aura, she was the one. Very interesting. Also, her last name was Spanish. Her name was Francesca Spanish.
Well, did you notice that everything is
nominative
silly.
Determinism.
I was born to speak Spanish.
She's like Hilaria Baldwin. I was born to be a Spanish. But everything is silly in this book. Like, anytime they describe the clothing people are wearing...
That's the only thing I highlighted, was what people were wearing. I didn't highlight the first few.
I don't remember exactly what any of them are specifically, but there's one where a guy's wearing, like, a toga, and he has on, like, one of those beanies with a propeller.
So, besides, stood a beetle-like individual wearing a continental outfit, tweed toga, loafers, crimson sash, and a purple airplane propeller beanie. That's what a person was wearing. Wait, and there was another, there were many very good ones, and then another very good one was a bald-headed man wagging a goatish beard pointed to himself. He wore old-fashioned, hip-hugging gold lamé trousers, yet somehow created a stylish effect. Perhaps the egg-sized buttons of his kelp-green mitty blouse helped. And then one more good one. This is really all I was highlighting.
just the clothes.
Did he have on, Joe said,
it's like American
did he
Psycho.
Have on green felt knickers, gray golf socks, badger hide, open midriff blouse, and imitation patent leather pumps? That's what they wore. It was like really funny. That part of this book was like satire.
I'm not sure what he was satirizing throughout this book, except for maybe just sci-fi.
Reality.
It's like, I mean, it's like silly cyberpunk.
A decade and a half before it was a thing.
Cyberpunk, he was just a fucking weird guy.
I mean, yeah. So everything's like silly and weird in this book. But then it gets to, you know, like the very serious question of like, what is reality?
You're like, oh, it's my hard God, to tell when you've this. Been like just doing acid for 5 years.
I think in Philip K. Dick's case, it was actually mental illness. It wasn't even just like hard drugs.
Well, he also apparently read the works of Socrates or Plato, rather, and was like, "You can't determine that the world is real." So,
that's like the whole physics people saying like, "We don't know if this is a simulation or not." Kind of vibe.
Right.
No, we can't prove that it's not a simulation because any test we do will just be part of the simulation. So, like, you can't ever run any sort of test that proves we're not living in a simulation. Sleep well tonight.
I will sleep well tonight, Nate, in this world or another one. I don't care.
No, just this one.
Yeah. This is the best they can come up with.
Scientists, but the point below. Of this. But the point of this book is that some of their people have been disappearing, and they're like, "What's going on? We're finding some signals that maybe they're on the moon," and so we've got to send up a crack team with this lady who's hiring them because she's like, "Hey, I got this secret mission, and we're gonna need a lot of anti-psychics because we think we have a psychic guy who's messing up our businesses." And he's like, "All right, let's go on a trip to the moon with the Ocean's 11 of the Motley Crew people." And then while they're on the space elevator, where the fuck it is, spaceship to the landing place, a little guy walks out. I was like, "Hey, it's that rich guy, you know, Stanton Mick," or whatever the fuck his name was. And then he explodes.
He's like, hey, how's it going? All of a sudden, he floats up to the air. And like, oh, my God, how much, just how much Taco Bell did he have? And he floats to this. And then they go, Arby's, he's going to, I've seen, and they say very calmly, oh, he's a bomb. He's going to explode now. And they go, oh, fuck, really? And then he does. And then nothing, if any of that made sense, you're ahead of the game. Because nothing after it does. And then they go, oh, fuck, he exploded. What happened? And they see Runciter is dead. And they go, quick, we have
he's
to get
like
him.
He's like almost dead. He's like on the cusp. He's like, we got to get this guy's body back to the place in Switzerland so they can freeze him and we can ask him how to run this business.
We have to take him to Switzerland where they only take payments in Jew gold.
Still, you did predict that one right.
And then they could freeze him. We'll be okay. And then they escape, and like, weird, like, nobody's fighting us. Like, it's like they're going to fight us somewhere else. Like, they tried to blow us up. This
also
is so
pretty
strange.
Lame bomb that just blew up the one old guy and saved all of us.
Yeah, but I guess maybe we don't count. Whatever. And then they go back to Earth, and they go back to the moratorium in Switzerland, and the guy's like, let me see what I could do about this fresh dead guy. And it goes back and forth. One guy calls another man an Uncle Tom for no reason. And then they go, nope, he's wasted. You left him out. He's like an old avocado that's been left out for 3 weeks on the table. There's nothing you could do about that.
Three weeks of being unripe and then 14 minutes of being ripe, and now he's no good.
That's the cycle of all avocados. It goes from rock to mush. And it's like those flowers that only bloom at like midnight once a year. You have to be there
for the flower at the end of Dennis the Menace.
That's exactly what I'm picturing.
Yeah.
Exactly what I was imagining.
I don't even know if that's real, but I believe it is because it's in
Dennis
the Menace.
Believe it's real because Walter Matthau told me it was real.
Walter Matthau has never lied a day in his life or death. Yeah.
He's still in Half-Life. He could still tell us his truths. So then they're like, oh, fuck, this guy's dead. And then, only then, can you say truthfully, the weirdest shit starts happening.
Yeah, this was definitely a point in this book where, oh, this started out weird, and then it got way weirder, and then it got way weirder again. So one of the reasons why I think this was entirely a first draft is I get to chapter whatever, and like the bomb has gone off, and they bring Runciter back to Earth, and like they try and put him on ice, and like so they can't talk. They try to talk to him through his Half-Life thing, and it doesn't work. And then Joe, who is now in charge, is like, Runciter always said never to leave Earth and definitely never go to the moon. It's like, well, then why the fuck did you do that?
Also, Joe Chip is broke. I don't know if we said that. He has no money. He's like, has to beg people to let him out of his time locked apartment. He's like,
my thing is broken on this side. Can you put a nickel in the door?
Put a nickel. At one point, he has to ask the woman who, you know, shows her titties to get the job, who her previous job was on a kibbutz. And he's like, you got extra nickels, right? And Philip K. Dick was like, I'm not playing into that stereotype. She does have extra nickels, goddammit. And then she lets him out. That's a real thing in the book.
It is.
I was like, wow, what's the kibbutz have to do with anything? There's a lot of nickels being passed around.
Turns out, nothing.
Nothing. Nothing at all.
It's like a Terry Gilliam movie where you're just like, I guess this is either a metaphor or I don't, or it's just weird for weird's sake.
So there's still... It's a very short book. There's still so much more weird stuff that happens. So immediately...
Can we just go back? We skipped over this part where they talk about the Ocean's 11 crew and just to how absurd like the lists of things is. And it kind of did remind me of American Psycho and just like the crazy detail that you're supposed to not even pay attention to. And he goes, a young string bean of a girl with glasses and straight lemon yellow hair, wearing a cowboy hat, Blake lace mantilla and Bermuda shorts. That would be Edie Dorn. A good-looking, older, dark woman with tricky, deranged eyes who wore a silk sari, a nylon obi, and bobby socks. Francie something. a part-time schizophrenic who imagined that sentient beings from Beetlejuice occasionally landed on the roof of her Connaught, which is what they call apartments, building. A woolly-haired adolescent boy wrapped in a superior and cynical cloud of pride, this one in a floral muumuu and spandex bloomers Runciter had never encountered before. I was like, my note was, I think this is one of the later verses of Piano Man. the people he's just describing here. It's just nonsense, it's just craziness. And I just thought that was a funny passage to highlight that. But go on, Nate, sorry.
So after Runciter dies and they can't revive him, a number of weird things start happening. First, everything that Joe like touches becomes old. Like his cup of coffee, he tries to put milk in his coffee, and it's like, this milk is spoiled. And they're like, oh, that's weird. And then he tries to put a nickel in some, was it a phone or something like that, a telephone booth, and it's like, this is not acceptable because this is fake. But it's also, it has Runciter's face on it. It's like the money has his face on it. It's like, that's weird. But then also weird stuff. They go, like, they get a hotel and they like go to bed, and then he wakes up, and then they wake up and they find the desiccated corpse of one of their people, one of their like, you know, psychic people in the thing,
closet.
In the closet. There you go. That's not a metaphor. in the closet. But it's just like, but it's like they've been there for a century, just drying out and mummifying. That's like, but you mean like overnight? Like, that's weird. And but they can hear. But when Joe wakes up and he like picks up the phone, because they have never heard of like having more than one line on the vid phone, they can, all he can do is he can hear Runciter's voice, but he can't like talk to him, but he can't make a phone call out. But also because they don't have any money, he can't you know, get room service. He like can't do anything. And he's like, well, this is really strange. And like, because, and then Wendy, that was her name, had died. So these like, and but also like, so like two things are happening. One of which is things are getting old, but also think like physical machines are reverting to like an earlier technological era.
Yeah.
At one point, he like goes back to his apartment, and it's like, oh my, fancy toaster is now just a like very normal toaster, and my refrigerator is clearly a belt refrigerator, you know, Frigidaire from the 1950s. This is weird. And everyone is very confused, including the reader.
Oh, especially the reader.
Well, they think they're being like hunted. So he's like, we got to find it, pick a place that, you know, let's pick a random place to go. And so they go to Baltimore, because that still exists in the future somehow.
And still sucks.
It still sucks. And still he buys a pack of cigarettes, and inside is a message from Runciter. And he's like, he always said he would never go to Baltimore. So how did he know that we would buy the cigarettes here at this place? And you're like, I guess I'll know later. And at this point, he's trying somehow. And you know, usually when we say somehow, it's just because we've forgotten something. At this point in this book, literally just somehow, they're going to Runciter's funeral, which is going to be in Idaho?
Des Moines, Iowa.
Des Moines, Iowa, the other one. And I forget how they end up on that quest, but also it might just be that that's what would happen, because it, reality is breaking down for both them and us.
And they're starting to get messages in random places, like in the bathroom, like weird limericks that are like, ha ha, you are dead.
It's and I am definitely not dead, but rhyming.
Yeah, it rhymes better than that, because that didn't rhyme at all. But
not much.
It's like, if you can count to five, you'll know I'm alive, but not you, because you're dead. Get it through your head. And they're like, what the fuck does this mean? I think Glenn's talking to us. And they're all just like, yeah, that makes sense to me. This is bizarre. And they settle in the year 1939. And like, this is, I feel like this is going to be a great year for Poland. And then they just...
Well, he has to get to the funeral in 1939, because he's going to meet everybody there. Somehow they all got separated. Who the fuck knows? Well, like he and Al just went to Baltimore and left the other guys there. And now they're all going to meet at the funeral. But as he's going to Des Moines, he met a man with seven wives. Never mind. That's not it. like the vehicles he's in get older as he gets there. He's like, I need to fly there. It's like, oh, well, we have this old biplane. It's like, get there in a day and a half or some shit.
So it's a Jenny or whatever.
yeah. And he's like, I'll trade you this car. It's like, that's a Model T. He's like, what the fuck?
So he leaves his apartment and it's like, so he lives in the year 1992, the futuristic year of 1992. And he leaves his apartment and there's like a Studebaker outside. He's like, I think this is what they call a car. Wait, I have keys in my pocket. And so he just goes and he figures out how to drive it, even though it's a, you know, stick shift. And he drives it to the airport because he needs to get to Des Moines. And he knows that reality is breaking down and he goes there. And then he turns around and, oh, it's no longer a whatever 1940s car. It is now a like 1929 like Model T. I'm like, oh, that's too bad. And because he was going to trade his car for a plane ticket, and they're like, no, nobody would even take that. But one guy decides to take him, and then
he trades him for a bottle of Ubik that he finds in the car, which is like, what's this Ubik? It's like, oh, it's this like hair tonic with gold flakes in it or some shit. Like my grandmother showed me a picture of it or some weird thing. It's like an antique. Like rare find. It's like, I'll take you to Des Moines for this thing. It's like, I don't know what this thing is. Fuck it. Yeah, here you go. There was every chapter starts with like an advertisement for Ubik, which is like the Acme company's like do everything product.
It's like now with more fiber. It's just random shit.
Now edible both ways.
And it ends with increasingly, don't take too much of it. You know,
completely safe when used as directed.
Yeah, but they use it, and then it's like, please avoid, you know, boofing this. You know, it just keeps getting more specific. And the bottle, and like first they're seeing Ubik as this like spray paint can, and then it moves back to just like some glass bottle, and then it's this weird handmade flask from a traveling medicine salesman from 1872 or something, and it's like essence of Ubik. And what does that mean? Fuck if I know, but that's a thing that's happening everything this and whole nothing. Time. Well, it's everywhere.
Much like the song by O-Town, it means all or nothing at all.
Nothing at all, yeah. But it's also a fucking thing in a glass bottle, and they don't know what's real or not. It's like it's Liquid Dreams, the other O-Town song.
Mm. No one knows their second O-Town song.
Everyone knows. Go look it up. It's like the third most played song on Spotify because there's two versions of All or Nothing at All. It's the first two. But yeah, they're like, what is this shit? And they're like, I don't know. What does it mean? That's for you to write your dissertation on, said Philip K. Dick. And then he moved on with his life.
So a biplane flies him to Des Moines, Iowa.
Bicurious plane.
It could go both ways. But it's 1939. Like he sees a newspaper and it's September 12th, 1939, also known as 12 days into World War II. And Poland is trying to hold on, but that's not an important thing.
Four horses are getting very tired.
They've run out of pierogies.
And he's taking like a cab around Des Moines to the funeral. He's like realizing like, wow, people in the past sure were racist.
He's at one point, he's like, I've never actually heard that word said.
You know, that Hitler guy, he had some good points. It's like, oh, no.
People keep asking him, oh, well, what do you think about this war that's going on? And he's like, yep, that's going to be a thing. And they kind of don't care, but which is much like Man in the High Castle, but we won't.
Still haven't read that.
So anyway, he goes to the funeral, and it's Glenn Runciter's funeral, but it's in Des Moines, Iowa, in 1939, and the rest of his crew is there, or the ones that haven't died yet. They're like, crew is there, and like, yeah, everything is weird, but yeah, we're here at the funeral, and then they're like, let's go to a hotel, and I'm probably like skipping a bunch of stuff, but then they go to the
maybe not.
Yeah, yeah, who knows? Was it important? Not a clue.
Don't know.
Go to a hotel, and it's like somehow Joe gets really old really fast, because that's what happens to people. They just suddenly get hit with the, like, I'm going to age.
Everything around them is aging crazily, or falling back through time, or just getting old. But occasionally it happens to the people, too. And it happens whenever they, like, separate from the group, because they've got, like, group time cohesion or something, maybe.
They get turned into a husk. But isn't that, Nate, I mean, you would know better than any of us, isn't that kind of how aging works? Just one day you look in the mirror and you're like, oh, my God, who am I? My dad.
It's a slow onset. Not like this book at all.
Trust me. He knows. He's been doing it for thousands of years.
And somehow they're in the lobby of a hotel in Des Moines, and Pat is there, and Pat is like, ha, ha, ha. See? They got pulled over, and there's a note from Runciter, which also doesn't make sense because he's dead, and it's 1939, and the policeman hands him a ticket, a speeding ticket.
But you were doing eight.
But on it, it says, don't. Yeah, you're doing 8.5. You know that's not allowed. Scrawled on the bottom of the note is a note from Runciter that says, don't trust Pat. And then Joe shows Pat the note that says, don't trust Pat. And she's like, you found out, you bastard. And then he starts to turn super old really fast. And he, like, then is the slowest stair walking scene that's ever occurred in literature, where he's trying to get to his room on the second floor so that he can just lie down for just rest his eyes. But yet she's like taunting him this whole time. Cause imagine a 100-year-old person trying to climb two flights of stairs. And he's like, no, I'm going to do it. And it's seriously like a quarter of the book is him just trying to get up these stairs. Maybe not that much, but it felt like it. It's a short book. So she's just like taunting him, and he's getting worse. He's like, no, I can do it. And then he gets to the top, and he gets to floor two and finds his room. And then when he opens the door of his room and Pat isn't there anymore, Glenn Runciter is sitting there in his room. And he's like, oh, I need to tell you what's really happened. You're dead, and I'm not. And
everyone's
you,
dead.
Everybody died in that bomb that happened way back in chapter 3, except for me. But you're all in half-life, but you're all like wired together. That's why you can kind of talk to each other, but yet that's why reality is breaking down, because you're actually in the dream world. And it's like, oh, God. Ugh, why is there still so much of this book left?
And also, someone is in there fucking you up. Because that whole thing of like, you know, the dream world doesn't work the same way. And there's some sort of weird infection happening with the strong-powered computer ghosts. It's like, so spray yourself with this. And he gives him a can of Ubik. And he sprays himself. He's like, ah, I feel better now. Why does that work? He's like, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter.
And it's basically Axe body spray.
Keeps you perpetually 13 years old.
You can't age when you smell like douche.
You smell like a middle school locker room.
Oh my God, I remember that was a big thing in a high school locker room. Jimmy, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You spray it directly into your urethra, things never smell again.
I felt like I would spray it into my locker at my disgusting gym clothes and slam the door shut like I was setting off a bug bomb.
Well, yeah, it was that, or like take your gym clothes home to be washed, which you're not going to do. Why would you do that?
I only did that.
You want to put on a wet shirt.
Teacher was like, you need to clean that, dude. I'm like, oh, okay, sorry.
Yours had blood all over it.
It's how tough I was.
It's because you got a nosebleed.
Fucking running the mile. I did have a nosebleed, and it stained because I didn't wash it right away. So, then the Ubik, don't think about that shit. That just happens.
That's, and you could say that for everything that happens in the book.
Confusion is ubiquitous.
But eventually, he's like, look, this shit's breaking down. Right now, you live in this half-life world where you just live in the greater Des Moines, Iowa area. So, you know, not really heaven, not really purgatory, somewhere in between. But if you just like vibe for a bit, it'll be okay. But you will continually try to break down because you're going to be attacked constantly by these other people.
And then you go to hell. You go to Tibetan hell.
You go to hell. But also, the end of the book is like, remember that thing that happened like on page 6? That was actually the whole point of the book. And you're like, what?
That what? the other dead guy was sneaking into their thoughts. And
there was like, there was a dead child hanging out with Runciter's wife. And he was like, I don't want to talk to this dead kid. I want to talk to my wife. He's like, nah, he's got this youthful Viagra energy. You know, he's got those like, he's just
permanent erection.
Yeah, just raging. So you can only hear him. And, he, you know, we don't understand why this works because we don't understand ghosts because we're just the Swiss. We just understand how to take gold from dead bodies, not how to like deal with them.
Just we're like really neutral in the ghost thing. We just try to stay out of it.
But it turns out that this same kid, his ghost is like taking over all the other ghosts because he gets really hungry for ghosts. Like Pac-Man. Which ironically, one of the levels of like not of hell in Buddhism is the hungry ghosts.
And the final boss of Buddhist hell is Blinky.
That's true. Yeah, that's actually also true. You have to defeat him to be born again.
No, to not be born again.
Oh, I think you have to do that during life. You have to defeat Blinky as an alive person.
No, it's Sue is the one you defeat to not be born again.
You defeat him as a dead person, and you get to go to New Life Plus, and then it's different the second time around.
Well, you reincarnate as Miss Pac-Man then.
You retain all your skills from the last time. But yeah, so then he's like, I gotta fight this kid. He's like, no, just spray yourself with this DEET for a while, and it'll keep your ghost safe. And that's
isn't that what we all want?
That's the end of the book, I think.
No, the end, the most important thing.
Still, oh, God.
What so happened? I don't even remember, man.
The only thing that really matters after that is they're all like, well, that's fucking weird. And then Runciter is like, yeah, that is weird. And then he pulls money out of his pocket. And he's like, what the fuck? This coin has Joe Chip on it. And you're like, Inception, yeah. And then it ends.
Yeah, that's the main thing. So a bunch of other stuff happens, and he's like, gets more Ubik or Ubik, and he conjures it with his mind.
He meets Ella. Runciter's wife, who's like still young and cool and living life in Des Moines.
She's been gone for a while, dead for a while, so there's not much of her left.
And he can summon a mid-level employee from the Ubik factory from the future who could give him new sprays so he can live out his eternity in Des Moines, Iowa, which might be hell.
I mean, this is the part where the book kind of turns into Vanilla Sky. So, you know, it's...
Yeah, I guess, kind of.
Yeah. So, Joe Chip is like,
Joe C.
Yeah, I have all this Ubik now, and I'm going to be fine.
Oh my God,
and then there's like one more little chapter where it's back in Glenn Runciter. He's actually alive, and he's like, oh, thank God I'm like, you know, helping all my people who almost died, or most of them are going to die, but I'm doing a thing. And then he takes a coin out of his pocket, and he's like, hey, hold on. Why is Joe Chip's face on the money? Which is a thing that had happened earlier, where Runciter's face was on the money in Joe P's world. And so it's like, as soon as I read that, I was like, oh, fuck you.
It's like Inception.
Even though I kind of, because it's Philip K. Dick, I had an idea that something weird like that would happen, or there would be no resolution. And I was both not surprised, but still annoyed. And so nothing makes sense. And the end. And I don't want to try.
It ends with the line, this was just the beginning. That's how it ends.
Like, if you want to take the door on the left, go to page 47. I want to see a book that turns into a choose your own adventure at the end of the book.
That'd be an incredible work of cleverness. So at the end, it's like, what is real? And you're like supposed to guess, I guess, or think about it.
Is the top his totem, or is it his wedding ring?
Is that what it was at the end of Inception? It wasn't the top?
Yeah, we don't know. The top was possibly his wife's totem. His was his wedding ring.
Oh, Jesus.
He never says what his was. Ah.
Really? I feel like maybe from made a big fucking
never says
deal
outright, this was mine.
But at the end, it doesn't matter, right? He's like,
I think that's a Linkin Park song, yeah.
In the end, it doesn't even matter. Yeah. Just like in this book, the end doesn't even matter. Or the middle or beginning. So what'd you guys think?
I liked it. It was a shit show, crapshoot of experiences, and I don't know what happened, but I had a great time. And you know, this is not one of the ones where it's like, I didn't really get it because I wasn't paying attention. I sat and I read it, and I paid real good attention, and I still didn't get it. And it's not like I didn't get the metaphors or like the, you know, the meanings, because there weren't any. It was just, fuck, I don't know what's going on. And I several times I had to go back. I was like, I feel like I missed something. I didn't. It just didn't make sense. And it was like, you know what? Fuck it. I had a good time. I had a great time, and I don't regret it, and I don't know what I got out of it. But it was pretty close to what it feels like to do drugs. Like the good ones.
Nate?
So,
I don't think you liked it.
I did not like it. I read it very carefully.
Like first mistake.
Usually, yeah, exactly. I remember when, like, thinking, because I was reading it very carefully, well, thank God I'm not skimming, when the bomb goes off, because it's literally like mid-paragraph. There's the man turns into a bomb and explodes, and it's like, wait, if I had just, like, skipped one line, I would
nobody
have
pulled his finger.
If I had just skipped one line, I would have no idea what's going on right now. And so I was like, this is so dumb. And then it was like, it felt like it was a first draft. Like, because, you know, they only had typewriters back then. So he wrote a chapter and he's like, I'm not going back. I'm not fixing that. I'm just going to do a new thing in the next chapter. Even though in the next chapter he says, oh yeah, that main character who's now dead said never to do that thing we just did. And he had us do. It's like, well, come on. Why'd you do that?
Well, they explain it because it was a big payday. You know, that was a big job.
Okay, that was post hoc rationalization. That is just, I'm not rewriting that chapter to fix that. That's really what happened.
I don't think so. The character, nobody questioned it beforehand. Everyone was like, ooh, big job. And then they're all upset that their boss died. And they're like, why did he even do that? They're just looking for a way to blame him.
The whole beginning was like, this company is like not doing very well. Like, we need a big job. And then this job comes out from this dude who's like, send whatever you need. Is like, we could really like bilk this guy, send like a huge amount of stuff. We could make enough money to like last forever if we just do this one gig. It's like, let's fucking do it. And it turns out that was maybe they all just died and it was all a con. There whatever was a job to it was just because all they do mention like the anti-psychics and the psychics sometimes kill each other. So it was just a way to take out a bunch of anti-psychics. And Pat was a plant that we never really understand how she was, but also the nature of her ability means you never really know if it's been used or not if she doesn't tell you outright.
You see, I think, so another way I think this was just a first draft is like he invented this character of Pat in the beginning of the book where, you know, she can like go back in time and like change subtle things. And then it's not used in the end for the second 80% of the book. Like it's mentioned a little bit where it's like, you don't know. Maybe she's using it, but then it's like, no, she's not. And at first, it's first when everything is going backwards in time. It's like, oh, it must be her that you're supposed to think, oh, she must have done it. But then it actually wasn't. It's actually just because they're in Half-Life and reality is breaking down, but she's doing it. But she also died, so like she didn't do it.
Well, I just you're supposed like, to assume it was her, but then you find out they're all dead, and she's dead too, and she thinks she's doing it.
She thinks she is, but I felt like it wasn't written well. Like that specific idea wasn't executed well.
Philip K. Dick,
that's what I mean.
Famously, like we've done a few of his things, and every time it's a really interesting, great idea. It's and like someone else makes crazy. A much better version of it later when they like iron out the details. But he's not a great writer. He's a great thinker of weird shit. But when he tries to get that out of his head, it's just like, this is just gibberish, Phil.
I think my problem with Philip K. Dick is that he has a cool idea, and then another cool idea, and another cool idea, and another 17 cool ideas. And he's like, that's one book. And you're like, no, those are 9 books. And he puts them all in, and no one idea gets developed or gets fully explored. You just kind of pick them up and abandon them throughout the book as he needs to or as he remembers to. And so things like this character who can go back in time, he's like, that's a cool idea. I'll put it here. And then he never really thinks, how do I like weave that in carefully throughout the rest of the book? He's like, and move on. And then, the psychic espionage stuff, does that matter? Is like, no, it really doesn't matter. It was just a way to get them all in one place and have them a reason to be there. He just has cool ideas, but they're not exercised out well, And his books always have like one or two too many ideas. This book has like 7 or 8 too many ideas.
Guys, I want you to do something. I want you to Google Philip K. Dick. And when the page pops up with all his pictures and all the other shit, I don't know if you get the same things as me, but I wanted to find out if you do.
Him with the cat?
Him with the cat, but like to the right of that, the New York Times article.
I love drugs.
I love drugs. Aliens have invaded Earth. The Corvinus Griffin people is like, okay, yeah.
He was I don't know, kind of trying to diagnose him with something, but like.
His middle name was Kindred. His K stands for Kindred. That's so weird.
That's rude.
That's the weirdest thing about him. Oh my God, his name was Phil Kindred Dick.
Who doesn't want to fill their kindred with a dick?
That's perfect. Come on. You can't get better than that.
But he also had a twin sister who died as an infant. And that, like, fucked him up for his whole life.
Oh, yeah.
And probably fucked up his idea. Like, what is real? What if she lived and I died? Like, he's a fucking weird guy.
That and the mental illness.
He was married and divorced 5 times.
You know, I respect someone who keeps trying.
It could just be because he was...
He still believed in love. you gotta respect that, I think.
He's a crazy dude. I just think he had cool ideas that were poorly executed. Kind of like how I think about Stephen King a lot of times. Only this is even more ridiculous and less penis.
It's similar. Like at least Stephen King's it's you could say the story has structure. However weird and bloated it may be or contain strange lines, like Philip K. Dick, he's got like, ooh, that's a cool idea. It's like, what if he made that into this? It's like, nah, what if there were also this? Like, no, Phil, don't do that. And he does that instead.
You're like, nah, Phil, don't do that. And he's like, what if I did it 3 times? You're like, that doesn't make it better.
Yeah. I mean, I liked it. I don't know if I would recommend this to anybody, though. And I don't want to read it again.
This is my second time reading it.
This was one of your choices of books that you want us to read.
Because when I read it, I thought it was fun, and it's fast.
It is fun.
And I read it in like a day and a half, and I was like, that was crazy, and I liked it. But I didn't really think about it much. I just probably was like, that ending, whoa! And then I moved on with my life. But people love this book. It's a lot of best novels of just... The 20th century will include this.
I will say it's probably, of the stuff I've read of his best book.
I think it's
the
most Philip K. Dick book.
It's up there, yeah. I mean, Electric Sheep was pretty out there, man. I don't know.
So I've only read this and Electric Sheep. I feel like Electric Sheep fit together a little bit better, not a lot better. But a little bit better than this did.
That had like one stupid thing with like the weird cult, the Mercerism. Like that could have been taken out and everything.
The cult that plays the video game of suffering or whatever.
Yeah, you just watch a video of an old man walking up a hill and you're like, that's Jesus, sort of. This had so many things that didn't matter that there was no book that did matter left.
I read a lot of his short stories.
I can only imagine what those are like.
You know, with like sometimes with sci-fi, short stories are better.
Oh, because they just have like a cool idea. Like, what if there was a spaceship run by farts?
It's really what if this was a thing? And you're like, oh, let's just vibe with what just right there. It's like, okay. So yeah, it does sometimes. Sometimes it works out.
What if there's a planet where you peed out of your butt?
A lot of the stuff that he wrote, Yeah, a lot of stuff he wrote short stories about were stuff that was then developed into much bigger things.
Apparently there's a short story that's related to this that he developed more this into. Yeah.
I don't know what you could develop this into.
Or he developed into this. I said that backwards.
Oh, okay. Sure. Oh, that makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm glad now I could say with confidence, I don't think it's that great. Though it's interesting. I think it suffers from this thing. If you read a lot of the 60s sci-fi writers, they were so eager to appear serious and so eager to be deep and heady. And I
think we're philosophers.
Yeah, I think a lot of them really thought that. And there's clearly, I mean, I don't know what he thought meant, but there's clearly an influence of also like Thomas Pynchon here. Just like the crazy weird shit. Like, does that matter or not? Like, this came out.
I will say this did make more sense than The Crying of Lot 49.
Not by much.
I think it's neck and neck.
I think this is influenced by that. And that type of writing, because that was the writer's
post-modern
writing.
Postmodern weirdness.
Yeah. Just like that was just, that's what it went to write if you were a writer with a capital W and not some, you know, trashy pulp writer like all of these guys started out in the 50s doing. Like, I think a lot of them really trying to be, you know, we're literary too. And it just kind of comes off as ridiculous. Like this.
What if the heat ray was a cold ray?
Cold Raymond to his, if you don't know him well. But they, you know, this book doesn't hold your hand, that's for sure. Instead, it's like it sends you into the woods at night.
Spits on your hand and then shits into it.
Hits you in the dick with a flashlight. And it's like, get lost. You're like, what's happening? And then every time you ask for help, it spins you in three circles with a blindfold on.
It screams book into your ear, and you go a little deaf, and you cry.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And then the sun never rises, and eventually you die in the woods alone. That's what this is like.
It's just an illusion, so it's okay, I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
The last thing you see is a pocket full of coins with Millard Fillmore on them. Oh, that was weird.
And then a man leans over to you, and he's a ghost, and he says, "Fill up this dick."
Okay. So it's weird. I don't regret making you guys read it because I think we had a fun discussion, but
I had a good time.
I think I'm good on the Philip K. Dick for a while. I really want to like him. I really want to like Philip K. Dick because he's like such a big, I really do, but it's just really not for me.
We've done the hits.
But there are, oh my God, that's the other thing I was saying. There are like 42 other novels by him.
No, we haven't done The Man in the High Castle, but like
I read that years ago.
Part of the cultural zeitgeist is gone, and I don't think we need to do it anymore.
But this is the like one of the greatest lost opportunities of all time. Is one of his.
I think I understood Ulysses better than Man in the High Castle. It's that.
What, that was that bad? It seems like such a straightforward plot.
No, it's not at all.
I guess
there's
no.
So much fucking I Ching nonsense in it.
So much weirdness.
I only know like the premise for the show.
Oh, the premise is great.
It is. It's like his other ones where they take a premise and then he ruins it. And someone says, "Hey, Phil, let's just do the original thing and we'll ignore the rest of this."
Yeah, most people when they like say, "Hey, Philip K. Dick, let's adapt that." All they do is they look at the table of contents and then everything else they ignore,
or just the fucking blurb, yeah.
The cover art. I think I got enough, but. So there's actually several lost Philip K. Dick books that he wrote.
He wrote Lost too? That makes sense.
Like he wrote them, submitted them to the publishers, they were rejected, he worked on them, and just those manuscripts were never published and they no longer exist. Nobody knows what happened to them, but they know that they did exist at one point. And
they are on Egyptian tablets somewhere.
They're in upstate New York. But there's one, and I'm not making this up, one of his lost novels, and Jimmy, you're going to understand immediately why this is sad for us. It's called A Time for George Stavros, and story about a 65-year-old Greek immigrant. That would have been the most fun book to talk about.
I really want to read that book.
It's lost. It's not here. Oh, God, no. It's all by.
You'll never find this book. I put it inside of secret recipe I have back home. Next Santorini, not in Santorini, where other peoples go, where the Xenos go. We don't want to go there.
You have to find it. It's inside of Minotaur's labyrinth. It's very hidden.
You know, for like a split second, I thought in my head that you were saying George Santos.
That would be
thought, did Philip K. Dick predict that's his, George he, Santos? Yeah,
forget moon travel. He predicted George Santos.
I mean, he's just weird enough that Philip K. Dick could have wrote the man. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, Philip K. Dick wrote it. Like, oh, okay.
Ooh, this is from Wikipedia on the article Lost Works of Philip K. Dick. A Time for George Stavros was written around 1955. A literary agency indexed the manuscript, and the index begins, quote, "Didn't like this before and still don't."
Can't imagine
so
why.
So like he had submitted a draft and they like gave him notes and then he turned it back and they're like, this is still garbage. But the synopsis is, quote, "A long, rambling, glum novel about a 65-year-old Greek immigrant who has a weakling son, a second son about whom he's indifferent, a wife who doesn't love him, she's being unfaithful to him. Nothing much happens." Goes on. Stavros, supposed to be symbol of vigorous individuality, of now a lost commodity. He wrote a book about Gus, the tzatziki sauce guy that Jimmy likes to... Jimmy's main character.
I would love to read that book. Should it come back into the cultural pantheon? I would read that right now.
So if you have a copy of The Time for George Stavros,
tell us what you thought. Send us an email to drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Twitter, DrunkGuysBC.
Or follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DrunkGuysBookClub.
And if you like the podcast, you can support it at patreon.com/drunkguysbookclub, or leave us a review, or just tell someone to check it out.
And join us on Goodreads, where we will be reading A Time for George Santos, the autobiography of someone else.
And check out the Hopped Up Network, a network of independent beer podcasters. And thanks for listening.